56% kommen aus Österreich.
Und 28 aus Deutschland. Also das sind nämlich unsere Hörer, falls ihr fragt, was wir da reden.
Genau, wir reden von unseren Zuhörerinnen und Zuhörern und das Verhältnis hat sich echt geändert, weil ich glaube zu Beginn unseres Podcasts noch im Februar, also so März, waren es 80% aus Österreich und ich glaube knapp über 10% aus Deutschland. Mhm. Es folgt die Schweiz.
Wenig überraschend. Und danach gleich, und das ist die große Überraschung, die Vereinigten Staaten von Amerika.
Gefolgt von der Türkei, also zwei Nicht-Austragungsländer.
Genau. Und was haben Estland und Costa Rica gemein?
Keine Ahnung.
Gleiche Downloadzahlen. Also ich meine, Estland nimmt ja teil, hat irgendwie auch eine Verbindung zum ESC, aber Costa Rica?
Vietnam, ein Download. Merci, chérie, der Eurovision Song Contest Podcast aus Wien.
Mir gegenüber sitzt Marco Schreuder.
Mein Vis-à-vis ist Alkis Vlasakakis.
Und der Titel der heutigen Podcast-Folge ist Eurovision Song Contest und die Wissenschaft.
Du hast es geschafft.
Ich habe solche Angst gehabt davor.
Wissenschaft und Vision.
Wissenschaft.
Ja. Ja. Kannst du dich noch erinnern, den Song Contest, Vision Song Contest, also so irgendwie hieß die Straßenkehrer-Geschichte.
Genau, die MA48 hat das ja als Logo plakatiert und das gibt es noch immer.
Genau. Ja. Was gibt's Neues, Alkis?
Bulgarien nimmt teil, sie kommen zurück. Danke, danke, danke dafür.
Ja, weil die sind schon sehr toll.
Ja.
Bei uns höre ich immer noch.
Ja, tolle, großartige Nummern.
Ob Symphonics das wieder macht?
Zu wünschen wäre es, also erfolgreich waren sie, ja.
Montenegro kenne ich mich überhaupt nicht mehr aus. Zuerst sagen sie ab und jetzt sagen sie, es ist doch nicht ganz entschieden.
Okay.
Und Ungarn?
Ja, schauen wir mal. Israel hat dafür zugesagt, die beginnen bereits mit den Vorbereitungen.
Ja, es geht los, gell? Jetzt im November.
Ja, bald. Ja, bald. Malta X-Faktor startet ebenfalls.
Na, ist ja schon im Laufen, glaube ich, oder?
Ja, na, die Vorrunden, aber die Finalrunden, da wird es dann langsam spannend.
So wie Georgien und so.
Georgien, da gibt es schon eine ganze Menge Finalisten und Semifinalisten. Also da werden wir schon bald ein Ergebnis haben.
Und kannst du dich erinnern, als ich dir sagte, dass ich es schade finde, dass die Tschechische Republik auf dieses Online-Format verzichtet und jetzt eine nationale Vorausscheidung so klassisch im Fernsehen machen will? Mhm. Sie haben das jetzt abgesagt und machen doch wieder so ein Online-Voting, wo hoffentlich ganz Europa wieder mitmachen darf, weil die haben so tolle Songs ausgesucht.
Genau.
Und ich hatte Angst, dass wenn das Publikum dann wieder so einer klassischen Fernsehsendung votet, wieder so irgendwie so der kleinste gemeinsame Nenner rauskommt. Mhm.
Sehe Deutschland. Ach, ja. Ja, nein, finde ich gut, finde ich großartig.
Und jetzt kommen wir aber zu meinem Lieblingsfestival.
Könnte das zufällig Sanremo sein?
Ja, Sanremo!
Ich finde es wirklich genial, dass die Teilnehmer und Teilnehmerinnen jetzt bereits im Vorfeld ansagen müssen, ob sie bei Gewinn zum Song Contest fahren oder nicht. Weil dieses stundenlange Warten, ich meine, wie lange geht die Sendung bis eins?
Also ich schaue ja jedes Jahr und es ist schon mühsam, weil es ist dann 1 Uhr schon oder 1:30 und dann sitzt du da und vor den Twitter-Kanälen, vor den offiziellen Kanälen, vor den Facebook-Seiten hast Rai Uno irgendwie noch laufen und denkst dir, nimmt er jetzt teil oder nicht? Ja? Also da bin ich schon sehr froh darüber.
Sag mal froh, dass es gewonnen hat und teilgenommen hat. Es hat sich ja ausgezahlt für Mahmut.
Und dann gibt es natürlich noch den anderen große Vorausscheidung, auf die anderen Fans immer so begierig sind.
Gibt es denn schon irgendwelche Gerüchte von Melodiefestivalen?
Es gibt zwei Namen.
Oh, erzähl.
Linda Bengtzing.
Linda?
Ja, und zwar jetzt zum 5. Mal, glaube ich. Oh. Vielleicht schafft sie es ja endlich. Und dann gibt es noch einen Namen.
Echt?
Ja. Erik Sade.
Er möchte popular werden. Ja. Aber was ist eigentlich mit Griechenland? Da gibt es ja auch dieses schöne Gerücht.
Ja, es heißt angeblich, aber ich weiß nicht, was ich davon halten soll, dass Kalomira wieder starten soll.
Das halte ich ja für unwahrscheinlich persönlich, weil die sind ja damals im Streit auseinandergegangen, nämlich der griechische Rundfunk und Kalomira da, das war nicht schön.
Vielleicht soll sich die Wissenschaft sich mal um dieses Thema bemühen.
Marco, wir haben einen Gast.
Heute zu Gast bei uns Dean Vuletic. Er hat das Buch geschrieben Post-War Europe and the Eurovision Song Contest. Und dieses Buch war eher so eine wissenschaftliche Studie und ist jetzt als Paperback, also als Taschenbuch erschienen und auch als E-Book. Und wir freuen uns, Dean zu Gast zu haben. Herzlich willkommen.
Vielen Dank.
Du sprichst ja auch Deutsch.
Ja, ich kann Deutsch natürlich. Ich wohne in Wien seit 7 Jahren, also... Aber leider...
I think we'll better switch to English, eh?
Sprechen Leute hier mehr Englisch mit mir.
Yes, also. and at the university, I think your whole work is in English.
Yeah, at the university, we actually speak English in the office as well. I think everyone just wants to practice English with me, so... You guys can do it as well today if you like.
Yes, we will do the interview in English because you are Australian.
I am actually Australian.
Yes. And your background is?
Croatian background.
Mm. How comes?
My parents left Yugoslavia in the 60s to settle in Australia.
Okay. So, and how does an Australian guy come to Vienna and researching about the Eurovision Song Contest?
Well, it's an interesting story, and I suppose my personal biography really reflects my interest in Eurovision. As a kid, I grew up in Australia watching Eurovision on television, on SBS, and it was very popular among, let's say, the Croatians in Australia, or the Italians, our Italian neighbors.
Or the Greeks as well.
Or the Greeks, exactly. So Australia's Southern European migrants really popularized Eurovision in Australia in the 80s and the 90s. So that's how I got into it. And then when I was studying European politics and languages at the Australian National University as an undergraduate, I remember writing one of my first essays on Eurovision, and my lecturer, she really liked it. And she thought it was a great idea. And then I started organizing parties with friends at the Australian National University, the first, let's say, Eurovision parties there. That was in the late 90s. And then in 1999, I spent a semester abroad in Jerusalem. Oh. And lo and behold, I got to see my first Eurovision live, which was a fantastic experience, especially at that time in Israel when it was a time of relative peace and you could easily travel around the region. So after that, I moved to the United States, where I did a master's at Yale University in East European Studies. And there I, you know, Eurovision wasn't a big thing then in the United States. It still isn't really, but...
maybe Netflix will change that.
Maybe Netflix will change it. I doubt it, though, but let's see. And then my connection with Eurovision wasn't as direct, but I was still watching it as much as I could. And let's fast forward to 2010, when I leave the United States. I finished my PhD in New York. And in my PhD, I looked at politics and popular music in Yugoslavia from 1945 to 1961. And I also looked at the question of, addressed the question of why Yugoslavia was the only communist state in Eurovision during the Cold War. And that was my springboard to start writing this book. So to write this book, I applied for a grant from the European Union, the Marie Skłodowska-Curie grant. And the reviewers thought it was an excellent idea to write this book about Eurovision, that it was very original. So I got this grant to come to the University of Vienna and do it. And so...
You got stuck.
Yeah. And now I'm writing another book on the Intervision Song Contest. So I don't know. It's a topic I'm really...
But you're a fan too, right?
Of course, I started out as a fan.
Yeah,
started so, out.
but I have the feeling that the Eurovision as an object of science is quite a new phenomenon. Yeah. No one ever had the idea. It was such a big pop cultural event, but nearly someone. It was more a journalistic thing that they searched for history stuff, mm-hmm. and it was not so much a university issue. And some people changed it, like Irving Volta and you, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But even when it came to the history of Eurovision, let's say there were a lot of, not a lot, but a few musicologists, sociologists talking about Eurovision in terms of fan culture or in terms of the music that is made. But no one had really addressed the history of the contest. And one of the issues that I had was that there were a lot of myths surrounding the contest, like that it was uniting Europe and that it had played such an important function in European integration, or the issue of the voting blocks. But no one had ever really gone into the archives of the European Broadcasting Union, the archives of the European Union, for example, to examine these issues and to determine what was factually correct. So this is why I wanted to write this book, because I thought that there were a lot of exaggerations when it came to Eurovision, a lot of myths, and that these needed to be addressed.
When you started out researching the Yugoslavian music, pop music, until 61, Yugoslavia took part of Eurovision in 62.
Started from 61.
From 61.
Yeah.
So it was probably a big step to the Yugoslavian ground is always having Eastern European pop music, Western European pop music, and then they start taking part in this Western European-dominated song contest. The Sobot Festival started around the same time, I think, 62.
Yes.
That was 62 starting. So they took the part there too, huh?
In Sobot, okay,
in Poland.
First, I just have to say that there is no Western European popular music and Eastern European popular music. There was so much exchange going on in terms of popular music.
Produced in those countries.
Okay, yeah, produced in those countries.
I don't see that as a different.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So Yugoslavia did participate in the Intervision Song Contest when it was first staged in Czechoslovakia from 1965 to 1968. And then in Sopot in Poland,
yes,
from 1977 to 1980. Yes. So it was in both.
Which is an interesting part. Though the Intervision and the Sopot weren't exactly Eastern European as there were US American artists, Canadian artists,
exactly,
British artists taking part and winning the contest in the 60s, 70s. And even stars like Johnny Cash taking part, which is amazing, during the Cold War.
Yeah, but it's not really, because there was so much cooperation going on between the European Broadcasting Union and its equivalent in Eastern Europe, the International Organization for Radio and Television. So this idea that we have of a Europe divided and of there not being much cooperation and exchange is actually false, because after the death of Stalin in 1953, relations essentially, well, greatly improved, and in many areas even normalized between Eastern and Western Europe. So you had a lot of cultural and technological exchange going on, especially when it came to popular culture. So the fact that American artists were invited to perform at Sopot in the late 1970s really wasn't anything that surprising in that era.
Maybe we should explain the listeners who have no idea what Sopot is. It was a festival which took place in Poland in the 70s and 80s. And before there was an Intervision Song Contest, it was at least they tried to have for the Intervision as a Eurovision Song Contest like event, which only took place I think 3 times, and it wasn't that big success as far as I know.
Okay, so the Sopot Song Festival, and I was actually just in Sopot last week.
No, it still exists.
Sopot still exists, yeah.
Yes, but not the festival.
Not the festival, but okay. You can go and visit it's called the Opera Leszna, this outdoor stage where Sopot was held, and they have some displays there that explain the history of the Sopot Song Festival. And Sopot is also a very beautiful town to visit. But the Sopot Song Festival started in the early 1960s. It actually first started in an entertainment hall in the Gdansk shipyard. And then in the late 1970s, it was rebranded as the Intervision Song Contest as an alternative to the Eurovision Song Contest. Not exactly as a competitor, because the organizers of Intervision wanted to cooperate with the people from Eurovision as well. And they even proposed having a contest that would pit the winners of Intervision and Eurovision against each other. But the organizers of Eurovision said no to this. But actually, in my research, I found that there was a first series of Intervision that was staged in Czechoslovakia from 1965 to 1968. And that was a project by Czechoslovak television, again, to have a competition model on Eurovision, but that would be pan-European. So again, it wasn't about making a contest that would be a communist alternative to Eurovision, but rather having a contest that would bring Eastern and Western European participants together. But the interesting thing is that the director of Czechoslovak television then, Jiří Pelikán, he approached his Western European counterparts at a meeting between the European Broadcasting Union and the International Organization for Radio and Television, and he said, why don't we do a joint song contest together? And remember, this is the period of de-Stalinization. You know, Khrushchev is in power in the Soviet Union, so relations between East and West are improving, are warming, and this was one of the ideas to reflect this culturally. And what's interesting again is that the Western European television officials say, no, we don't want to do a song contest with you.
So there was more a hand that reached from the East and from the West.
Yes, yeah. And you know, this is also what people often don't expect, yeah, when they think about Eastern Europe. But the reasons for this was that the Eastern Europeans wanted to open up. You know, the television officials wanted to open up. The record companies wanted to have access to Western European markets. Artists wanted to use the contest as a springboard to establish careers across Europe, especially, let's say, in West Germany, which was a very important market for them. Think about Karel Gott, for example, who recently passed away. So these ideas, preconceptions that people often have of Eastern Europe as being closed, anti-capitalist or anti-commercial, are not true when it comes to the Intervision Song Contest.
Let's go back to your book, because when I was reading your book, I could and we already did an interview for the Standards. We can, yeah, link it in the show notes. You found actually, so your research came to a result: the Eurovision Song Contest did not make any history, or nearly not make any history. It did more reflect history. Is that the base of your research? Could you explain this?
I would say that's definitely one of the conclusions, because again, going back to what I said earlier, some commentators, or let's say commentators slash fans of Eurovision, have said that Eurovision has changed European history. But there are only some things that I think it has changed. I don't think it has left a lasting political impact in many areas.
On Europe.
On Europe, exactly.
And on different countries?
On different countries as well. Let's say if we look at Azerbaijan, which is an example I end with to demonstrate my argument. There was so much hope that Eurovision in 2012 in Baku could change something politically in Azerbaijan. And there were so many statements made, yeah, by officials from the European Union, other politicians from Europe, about how Eurovision could have a long-lasting impact on Azerbaijan, especially by freeing up the political system, promoting media freedom. Since then, we've seen the media freedom situation in Azerbaijan worsen.
Rasul Jafarov, who organized Sing for Democracy
exactly
during the Eurovision Song Contest 2012, and I was there, he went to prison afterwards and he had to stay in prison for a year. He lives in Budapest now.
Yeah. So, and do you hear anyone from, let's say, the organization of Eurovision asking about this anymore? They don't make a stand. Once the contest is over, that's it. The question of Eurovision's legacy is never brought up. And yeah, I think this is something we need to think about.
But don't you think that some Eurovision happenings did change something in a country? Like, for example, the win of ABBA for the music industry in Sweden, the win of Dana International for the LGBTIQ rights in Israel, or even Conchita in Austria, when the discussion about equal rights had a different shift suddenly. Don't you think that there is a kind of an impact, or let's say maybe a motor for promoting, or that it's get a new spin for these debates which are going on anyway?
Yes, definitely. There are cases. But when you look at the history more broadly, these cases, I think, are rather rare.
But so, the reflection is there. I mean, let's have a look at on the Russian-Ukrainian conflict, for example, which we have this conflict at Eurovision as well.
We've had it for a long time now. Yes.
Now, yeah, exactly. Well, yeah. So the whole situation reflects. You can see Eurovision, and you see what is going on in Europe at the moment, right?
Yes, you can. Yeah, that's exactly it. And this is why when I wrote my book, I watched every single contest. I mean, the book focuses on the first 60 years of Eurovision. So I looked at every single contest from those years. I analyzed what the host was saying. I analyzed the lyrics of every song, all of the postcards.
Did you have help or did you do that alone?
No, it was done all by myself.
Oh my God. That must be a horrible work.
Almost 1,500.
How many la la las did you read?
Yeah, well, see, this is something that I don't really address in my book. These sort of fun facts that are presented in Eurovision, especially in recent years, in the show, almost every year now. This is something I actually find disappointing, because I think Eurovision has a much richer history, but it seems to be a history that the producers of the contest don't really want to engage with. Maybe then they think that the show will become too political. And so this is something that I also wanted to address. I wanted to present a history of Eurovision from a political perspective. Some would say a serious perspective. And it is. You won't find, you know, the fun facts like how many la-la-las or the highest note. You know, for that, watch the contest itself. But I wanted to show that there has been a lot of serious politics going on in Eurovision, especially behind the scenes. And I, you know, getting back to your point, I want to show that it has been an important product of politics in Europe. So again, you know, I don't want to underestimate its importance, because I agree with you, there were very important things that Eurovision did have an impact on and did change. But what I think I want to demonstrate in my book is that it has been such an important subject of political interest in Europe throughout the whole post-war era. So that, you know, when the critics say that this event is a joke, that the music is of poor quality, that the voting is rigged and things like that, really they're missing the point that really, you know, ever since 1956, Eurovision has been a subject of interest of Europe's political establishment. And this is what I wanted to demonstrate in this book.
But the EBU always, the organizers of the Eurovision Song Contest, always state that they try to be apolitical. So how does that go together? How do they cover up the political aspects?
Of course. Well, I think that they have to say that.
Yes.
Because if they said it was political, or if they tolerated it, tolerated, let's say, the politicization of the contest, then it would get too messy with all of the countries that, you know, they have to deal with. So I understand why they present that view, that approach. But the European Broadcasting
Union... And then they fine Iceland with 5,000 euro.
Yeah, well, exactly. But, you know, politics means different things. And, you know, Conchita Wurst's performance was definitely political.
Jamala.
And I think the Jamala case was the most interesting because there was so much controversy, and even within the European Broadcasting Union, the head of the European Broadcasting Union and, you know, the executive supervisor of Eurovision, you know, there were even differences there among the members of the reference group, for example. So, but I think personally, you know, there was no reason to ban that song. It speaks of an example of ethnic cleansing in Europe during the Second World War, Crimean, Tatars, Muslims.
She was singing about her grandma.
Exactly.
And it's allowed to sing about a grandma.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Does that mean then that we can't have songs about the Holocaust, for example?
Yeah.
Or songs about, you know, any...
But it already started actually very early, because already in the early 60s, we had political songs. I just think about Zwei kleine Italiener.
Exactly.
Which was about migration, or Diese Welt from Katja Epstein, which was the first song at Eurovision about ecological issues. So it's always in negotiation, I think, where to draw a line. What is a political song and what is not a political song?
Yeah, exactly.
And I Want to Put In was not allowed, for example.
No,
Georgia,
that was too blunt.
Yeah, they wouldn't have gone anyway then. I mean, you know.
I still like the song, by the way.
Me too. But, you know, relations between Georgia and Russia were so tense at that time that...
Yeah, it was a war.
Exactly. Yeah. It wouldn't have been an easy job for the Georgians to go to Moscow then. So, yeah, this... I mean, it's always political, but it's an international organization, the European Broadcasting Union. What I say in my book is that the essential problem is that already in the early 1960s, the European Broadcasting Union decided that the entries on stage should appear under the names of states.
Mm-hmm.
So beforehand... they were discussing whether on the scoreboard they should have the name of the national broadcasting organizations or the names of states. And they went for the names of states because they're shorter and better known to the international public.
It's more emotional, I think.
And they said this as well, that, you know, this will also make the contest more exciting. So this is, you know, essentially the crux of the problem, because if you just had BBC or RF, maybe it wouldn't be so emotional as it is, yeah.
In the book, there is one episode where you... was it in the book or the interview? Where you're talking about the first Bosnian entry, for example. And I was reminded by the story that is told in U2's Miss Sarajevo, for example, where they had the beauty pageant during the war. And it was... more or less the same issue, sending the first Bosnian act to Eurovision during the war. That was one of the most moving parts that I read. So so there are some quite emotional parts as well to discover in Eurovision, in the story how artists come to Eurovision, how they try to enter this dream.
Exactly. No, that's one of the most emotional stories, I think, that I encountered with regards to Eurovision. And I interviewed Ismeta Dervoz, who led the Bosnian delegation at that time.
You invited her to Vienna to a conference
as well. She spoke at this symposium that we had on Eurovision when the contest was here in 2015.
I remember.
So you do have many of these stories where, you know, it's more than just about the personal career of the artist or the television official involved, where the story is a much bigger one about war, independence.
I mean, they didn't know if they come alive to Ireland, right?
Well, exactly. It was a big...
I mean, that's a story.
Trip, exactly.
I mean, to flee from the snipers.
Yeah.
I mean, We could talk about a lot of details of your book right now, of course, and then this podcast episode will last, I think, 5 hours, or you could run your own podcast just with the stories you're writing about. But which archives did you actually research? Because I think, or what I would like is, of course, that a lot of history students feel inspired that they look for their national archives and research more, because I think we can find a lot of things we don't even know yet.
I absolutely agree with you, and I think this is something that researchers who would like to explore the history of Eurovision further could do, because there are just so many different national broadcasting organizations involved. But I started with my PhD by looking at the archives of Yugoslav television, and they were great because there I saw the discussions regarding Yugoslavia's participation in Eurovision and how the television officials felt that Yugoslavia was somehow being discriminated against in the contest with poor voting results because it was communist and Slavic, Eastern European, and so on. They really felt like outsiders in the contest, which is why they withdrew from Eurovision in the late 1970s for a couple of years.
One more question about Yugoslavia. Did they also discussion about which language should be sent? I mean, they also had inner Yugoslav discussions about should it be Slovenian, Croatian, Bosnian, and they never, I think they never sent an Albanian song.
No. They never sent an Albanian song, which I think says something very interesting about the position of Kosovan Albanians in Yugoslavia. And I just actually wrote an article on Kosovo wanting to be in Eurovision, and this is something I discussed there as well. But they didn't have, let's say, a method of having each of the major linguistic groups in Yugoslavia represented in Eurovision. So there was no Macedonian language entry ever, for example. Most of the songs were in Serbo-Croatian, as the language or group of languages was then known. And most of the songs ended up coming from Croatia, from Television Zagreb, and that partly had to do with the fact that that was really the center of the Yugoslav popular music industry, especially with the record company Jugoton in Zagreb, which was the leading popular music record company in Yugoslavia. So to go back to your question about the archives, after the Yugoslav archives, I then also consulted the archives of the European Broadcasting Union.
You were the first one, you told me, right? Who researched on some archives?
I think the first historian, certainly the first one to go through all of the documents on Eurovision, yes. And the archives of Czech television, because that's where you can find documents related to the Intervision Song Contest. That's where the International Organization for Radio and Television was headquartered, in Prague. And of German television. Where else? It's all in my book. You'll see that there's a long list.
We'll link to the editor, to Bloomsbury.
Yeah, thank you.
Karel Gott, you already mentioned his name, and he just recently died. So let's focus just on this story and for a short moment to remember this man. Mm. But it's also a political interesting thing, right?
Absolutely.
Austria did send a Czech singer, a not so known Czech singer at that time. He became a huge star then. Mm. In Czechoslovakia, he was already a big star.
Yes, he had already won this Intervision Song Contest.
Yeah, and Austria, and it was in the year of the
Prague Spring. Yes, 1968.
And the ORF played a very big role. The Austrian broadcaster played a big role in the communication between East and West. During Prague Spring, and then the TV director who was responsible for the Eurovision Song Contest, a guy called Helmut Zilk, who later became mayor of Vienna, actually, decided to send a Czech singer as representative of Austria with a song written by Udo Jürgens. How political was that?
It was definitely a statement about the opening up of Czechoslovakia, because the Prague Spring began in early 1968, and that was basically a time when censorship of the media ended in Czechoslovakia. So Czechoslovakia really became the most open country in Eastern Europe. And this also led to greater cooperation between the Czechoslovak and Austrian national broadcasters. So it wasn't just the selection of Karel Gott that reflected Austria's support for the changes in the Prague Spring. There was so much cooperation that was going on between the two national broadcasters at the time. And this was just one reflection of that. But a very important one for Eurovision, because this was the first time that a citizen from an Eastern Bloc state appeared on the Eurovision stage. And his song was also very meaningful. I think if you analyze the lyrics, it talks about neighbors not knowing each other. And, you know, there's this whole context of the problem of social alienation in modern life. But I think that it's also an allusion to the Iron Curtain division between Eastern and Western Europe, and between Czechoslovakia and Austria, of course. You know, we have to always remember that Bratislava and Vienna are the two European capitals that are closest to each other geographically. So there was a lot of cooperation going on between Austria and Czechoslovakia at this stage, and this was certainly one very significant symbolic representation of that.
Thank you very much. We'll probably link to the book. No, definitely we'll link to the book. And it's the end. So we have three questions for you.
Oh,
yeah.
The what most shame, important
because I could
ones.
Speak with you guys.
I know.
We know that. You could, I told you, you could run your own podcast.
But maybe we'll do that, Marco, together.
I have one last question. One. Because it's really, I wanted to ask this question all the time. Which was the first political reflection in the Eurovision history?
Oh, it was there from the start. I mean, Dutch as well.
Yes.
And, you know, what was the first Eurovision song?
The Vogels van Holland.
Exactly.
And I talked to you about that in one episode.
You did.
Yatipan.
Yeah.
No, already 1956 was, you know, for me, it was a very interesting year because it set a lot of these political precedents for Eurovision. So you had Walter Andreas Schwarz, a Jew, a concentration camp survivor representing West Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What, you know, automatically a political statement.
And the first Israeli singer at the Eurovision Song Contest was representing Austria.
Yes, exactly.
I will meet her.
Carmela Koren. Give her my regards. Say shalom.
Okay.
And that we had a wonderful time in Tel Aviv this year.
Yes, we had.
So, now the questions. First question is, which one is your... Maybe, Marco, you should ask this question.
Yeah, I will ask this question because you already answered this question once. Yeah. We had an interview with The Standard, I think, last year.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Last year. Before
and it was, we will link the interview too. And I already asked you the question, which is your all-time favorite from all Eurovision? And your answer was Gente di Mare.
Yes.
Is it still your most favorite song of all time?
I mean, I often get asked this question by journalists. And in the end, initially, you know, I would always have to think. And then I thought, okay, you just have to come up with one you really like to give them an answer. So Gente di Mare is my standard answer.
So it stands with Raff and Umberto Tozzi.
Yes, I love...
it's Italy.
Italian songs.
Which year was it?
94? I think. You're the nerd, Marco.
Yes, I think it's 94. Yeah,
we'll find out.
Early
80s.
Yeah. It's the
early
80s.
1987. I think it's 1987. I will have a look now.
Yeah.
Yes.
Have a look.
Yeah.
Please.
You hear a keyboard now.
But there are a lot of other ones that I really do like.
Yeah, it was 1987.
Oh, well done.
87.
So
he's a nerd, by.
Should I list them? I don't know. There are just so many, and so many of them are interesting. And when you actually analyze them and, you know, look at the lyrics, a lot of the songs surprise you because, you know, you didn't know what they were talking about and you realize that actually they have very deep meanings. And so it's hard for me to really isolate one, but I'd have to say if there was a country that I would say is my favorite in Eurovision, then I would have to say Italy because I love Italian popular music.
I totally agree on that. And Dean, we have the same taste in this. So I think Italy should have won Eurovision like 15 times or something.
You're so boring, both
and
of
you.
You
know, as they say, magic, oh magic. Yeah.
Not that song, but I think it had to start with Romantica and all the songs. They were fabulous. Okay, the next question, Altis.
Is there any maybe guilty pleasure or anecdote about Eurovision that you would like to tell us?
Or maybe because you wrote this book, a favorite story you found out in your research.
Right. Okay, yeah, let's answer it that way. Because when I was doing the research in the archives, I found amazing documents, you know, things that really surprise you and put a smile on your face. And I think this is the thing I love about my job. You're a bit like a detective, and there are a lot of papers you have to go through and things you have to sort through to put together this narrative. But then sometimes there are just gems that make your day. So let's go back to the early 1980s. Just after Eurovision was staged in Jerusalem in 1979, and we know that that contest was staged just after the signing of the peace treaty between Israel and Egypt. And then there was a lot of talk that Egypt might now enter Eurovision. And I actually found correspondence about this in the archives of the European Broadcasting Union. And the gem of a document that I found was a telex. Younger viewers probably won't know what a telex is, but, you know, look it up. it's something like an email.
An email sent by fax.
Exactly. Yeah.
I worked in a hotel in the 80s, and I always got the reservations by telex.
Yeah. And which is also the name of...
Yes, the Belgium...
In Eurovision, exactly. So there's this telex from Cairo, from the Egyptian national broadcaster, and sent to the European Broadcasting Union. And the telex basically says, "We would like to enter Eurovision. However, could you ensure that we not get first place?" Basically, because they didn't want to host it, have the financial cost of hosting it. So, you know, this is actually...
I think this is the telex that Rice sends every year.
Yeah, exactly. This is something we all know is rather true for a lot of national broadcasting organizations, but only the Egyptians were clear about it from the start. And then the European Broadcasting Union writes back and says, well, we can't, you know, guarantee who's going to win, so... No.
But it was Morocco the next year and not Egypt.
Yeah, and so Morocco comes to Eurovision as the first Arab state in 1980. And last,
Which is a shame. I mean, 1980 could have been then Egypt and Morocco, which would have helped them both.
Could you do me a favor, by the way?
Yes.
We made an own episode with Irving Benoit Walter because we cannot find the Austrian participant from 1962. She's called Eleonore Schwarz, and no one knows what happened to her after 1968. We lost all traces. So maybe also one of your students and on the university would like to research because we would like to find her.
Okay. Yeah, I'll keep that in mind.
At least get the story behind that.
So the last question.
Last question. Is there any song of this year's, of 2019, Eurovision, that's still on your playlist?
It's funny that after, maybe it's the same with you guys, but once Eurovision ends, you know, you listen to the songs a bit more during the summer. But then I find there's a six-month break, you know, when we're rather... Eurovision free. So for me, the beginning of the year is always very intense with lectures and, you know, speaking engagements and so on, and following all the developments for the preparation of the contest in that year. And so then, you know, in the second half of the year, maybe I'm not listening to the Eurovision songs that much. But I have to say, one song keeps coming back to mind, and I keep humming it, and it's the Greek song Better Love by Katerina Duska. Yeah. Okay. So,
thank you.
This is the one I would say has stuck with me the most this year.
Funny. I can't even remember how it sounds like.
Better love.
Yeah, I know. I remember it. I didn't like it. Anyway, thanks a lot for coming here. And I think everyone should read your book. And every historian should be inspired to make research, because there are so many things we would like to know about the history of Eurovision. Right? Yeah,
there's still a lot more to discover, and hopefully also my new book on the Intervision Song Contest will teach everybody a lot of new things.
You're writing a new book about the Intervision?
Yeah, I'm writing a new book. When this is why I was in Sopot last week. I'd say I'll finish it next year, and it will be interesting also to talk about it next year and the year after, because we will have the commemorations for the Solidarity strikes in Poland.
True.
And in 1981, the introduction of martial law in Poland. So
bring us a winner of Intervision, and we will come together next year for a new episode of Merci Chérie.
Helena Vondráčková.
Yeah, bring her.
I'm
a big fan.
Or we're going to Prague. Yeah, no.
Why
problem.
Not? Let's go to Prague. I'm sure there's a lot to discover there, trust me. You know, the Czechs have not been the most enthusiastic participants in Eurovision. Recent years, it's improved, but they were the last country from Central and East Europe to be represented in Eurovision. They only debuted in 2007. Azerbaijan was 2008. So, but they were the last, let's say, of the new members of the European Union. But people don't know that this first Intervision was staged in Czechoslovakia from 1965 to 1968. And the Czechs were really an important popular music power in Eastern Europe during the Cold War. So there is a lot of interesting history to discover there.
I grew up during the time. I know them all.
Yeah. So what I just figured out is you're an Australian, and your all-time favorite and your 2019 favorite is not an Australian song. You're not very nationalistic when it comes to Eurovision. Or you like the Australian entries.
Let's just say I think there are a lot of questions still about Australia being in Eurovision. I'm familiar with, you know, Australian politics, the still unresolved issues of Australian national identity. So I'm quite critical, actually, of what happens in Australia politically. I'm quite critical of how Australian multiculturalism has developed. I'm against the fact that the British monarch is the Australian head of state, that we still have the Union Jack in the Australian flag, all of these symbolic issues.
And the refugees on an island.
Exactly. All of these issues that actually say to me, I personally, but a lot of other people, are still not fully a part of that country or a part of that country's identity.
But do you think it's a good idea that Australia participates at Eurovision as an Australian?
I think that Eurovision should still very much be a European thing, because I think Europe needs Eurovision a lot right now. And having Australia in Eurovision is really just a reflection of the European Broadcasting Union's ambitions to turn Eurovision into a global brand. But I don't think it's the brand that we should be focusing on. I think it's the symbol that we should be focusing on, and the fact that Eurovision has managed for over 60 years to bring Europeans together to watch this show that has become one of the greatest popular cultural phenomena in Europe. So this is why, for me, having Australia in Eurovision and trying to expand to the United States and China.
That was such a beautiful last language and last word subject. And now you're starting again with Australia. Stop it. That was great, because it's the spirit of Eurovision that
counts. That's what I think, and that's what I think is important, not the commercial side. not the brand, but, you know, the fact that Europe is coming together once a year to watch this. And that, you know, when I researched around Europe, that's the great thing about Eurovision. Wherever you go, people know about it and they have something to say about it.
So that's why we say, merci, merci chérie.
Danke schön.
Merci, chérie. Die kleine Song Contest Geschichte am Schluss. Hast du mir was mitgebracht, Marco?
Ja, ich habe dir etwas mitgebracht. Wir haben jetzt schon darüber gesprochen, aber nachdem Karel Gott tatsächlich jetzt gestorben ist und wir wollten ihn ja so gerne interviewen,
ja,
habe ich mir gedacht, erzähle ich doch noch die Geschichte auch über die Rolle des ORF während des Prager Frühlings.
Oh.
Der ORF-Intendant damals hieß Gerd Bacher. Er war eigentlich ein bürgerlich-konservativer, aber er hat mit dem Helmut Zilk auch einen Sozialdemokraten zur Seite gehabt, der Unterhaltungschef war. Und mitten im Prager Frühling hat sich der ORF eben entschieden, den Karel Gott, also den tschechischen Sender für Österreich, an den Start zu gehen, der auch noch 1000 Fenster sang, ein Song von Udo Jürgens. Und wenn man sich diesen Song einfach anhört, dann merkt man schon, dass da auch eine versteckte politische Botschaft drin steckt. Also wenn da lauter Fenster aufgehen, ne?
Ja, genau.
So, haben wir eh besprochen. Auf jeden Fall interessant ist tatsächlich, ich meine, der Eurovision Song Contest 1968, der fand in London statt am 6. April und nur einen Tag zuvor hat die neue Regierung ein neues Programm veröffentlicht. Also wirklich einen Tag davor, da sieht man, wie eingebettet das mitten im Prager Frühling auch dieser Auftritt beim Song Contest war. Und in diesem Programm hat man eben Unglaubliches vorgeschlagen. Presse- und Meinungsfreiheit zum Beispiel. Ja, und das war natürlich ein Riesenthema. Und entstanden ist ja der Prager Frühling ja durch mehrere Faktoren. Da gab es mehreres, was zusammenkam. Unter anderem eine durchaus auch slowakische, nationalistische Richtung, die sich mehr Mitspracherecht wünschten. Und Alexander Dubček war ja ein Slowake und der hat eben im Jänner 68 dann die KPC übernommen, diese kommunistische Partei. Und der hat dann diesen Reformprozess, diesen Prager Frühling im Grunde ins Leben gerufen. Ja, und dann kam dieser Song Contest und wie wir wissen, ist das Ganze dann natürlich auch schief gegangen. Die Reformbewegungen rollten an, die Tschechen und die Slowaken waren in ihrem damaligen Tschechoslowakei glücklich. Ja, und dann ist am 21. August sind die Panzer der Sowjetunion und dann alle der Alliierten der Sowjetunion, also des Warschauer Paktes, einmarschiert. Einer der treibenden Kräfte des Einmarsches, die DDR selber, hat sich dann aber nicht getraut. Also man hatte Angst vor deutschen Soldaten wieder in der Tschechischen Republik.
Das war historisch furchtbar.
Ja. Das war belastet, genau. Ja. Obwohl sie eigentlich so eine treibende Kraft waren, ja, gegen den Prager Frühling. Und ja, und dann hat ORF eine sehr interessante Rolle übernommen. Sie haben quasi den gestürzten tschechischen und slowakischen öffentlich-rechtlichen Sender, den tschechoslowakischen öffentlich-rechtlichen Sender, quasi aufgenommen bei sich und haben ein Dissidentenfernsehen quasi gestartet und Radio. Und sie waren die Außenstelle, wenn man so möchte, des gestürzten Prager Frühlings, was dann eine Rüge einbrachte seitens des Bundeskanzlers Josef Klaus von der konservativen ÖVP, weil der ORF die Neutralität nicht wahren würde. Mhm. Diesen Konflikt gab es auch gegenüber den Flüchtlingen. Es ist damals sind sehr, sehr viele Flüchtlinge aus der Tschechischen Republik und aus der Slowakei, also aus der Tschechoslowakei damals, da war ja noch ein Staat, nach Österreich geflohen.
Mein Onkel zum Beispiel, also nicht nach Österreich, sondern in die Schweiz, aber mein Onkel kommt genau aus dieser, aber andere Geschichte.
Ja, aber du hast ja schon einmal angedeutet, genau. Mhm. Ja. Und ja, interessante Geschichte auf jeden Fall. Und der Botschafter, der österreichische Botschafter in Prag, der hat diese Visas ausgestellt, nach und nach, und hat diesen Flüchtlingen die Flucht ermöglicht. Dieser Mann hieß Rudolf Kirchschläger und wurde später einer von den Sozialdemokraten nominierter Bundespräsident. Und derjenige, der es ihm verboten hatte, Visas auszustellen, um ja keine Flüchtlinge reinzulassen, war der damalige Außenminister. Und weißt du, wer das war?
Ich ahne es.
Das war der Kurt Waldheim. Und das ist meine Song Contest-Geschichte am Schluss.
Wie sagt man eigentlich auf Tschechisch?
Děkuji. Aber wir sagen?
Merci, chéri.
Missing Link.